Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. The first votes in the 2022 midterm election, well, they were cast almost 5 months ago when Alabama held the nation's earliest primary contest way back in May. And it's all going to be over in less than a month when voters cast their final ballots of this midterm season on November 8th. And in the months between filing deadlines, primary battles, general election campaigns, and election night announcements, millions of Americans make thousands of choices. They decide the leadership of American counties, cities, and states. They choose the entire U.S. House and about a third of the U.S. Senate. These are the choices that shape the future of our country. And how do folks who are living their lives, paying their bills, working their jobs, rearing their kids, how do they make all these big decisions? Well, there's all those shiny flyers that show up in your mailbox. There's radio, TV, and internet pop-up ads. And there are debates. Like last night, when U.S. Senate candidates Democrat Tim Ryan and Republican J.D. Vance squared off in the first and only debate of the U.S. Senate race in Ohio. Theirs was an exchange that covered well-trodden ground from this year.
J.D. Vance, he supports a national abortion ban in which he wants women to have to get a passport and go to Canada. Like, we've got to have some moderation on this issue. He's got a very extreme position.
He talks about wanting to support a stronger border. He talks about wanting to be bipartisan and get things done. Well, Tim, you've been in Congress for 20 years, and the border problem has got worse and worse and worse.
But these days, there are far fewer debates to help voters decide. In fact, a new analysis from the Brookings Institution finds that the number of debates in the five most competitive Senate races, well, they've dropped from 17 races back in 2010 to just 7 planned for this year. So is the great debate a thing of the past? And do the debates that are still happening make any difference? With me now is Joel Payne, CBS News political contributor. Joel, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Good to be with you, Melissa.
And also with us is Brendan Buck, partner at Seven Letter, a Washington and Boston-based public affairs firm and formerly a senior staffer for House Speakers Paul Ryan and John Boehner. It is always great to have you, Brendan.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you.
All right. So here's the big picture. Joel, I'm going to start with you. What are you seeing in the debates that are actually happening?
I'm seeing a lot. And it's so funny because people like to tell the story of any election cycle, particularly midterms, as like one national story. And it's not. It's a series of local laboratories. And I've kind of boiled it down to like four key issues that I'm looking at. And it's four C's: candidates, choice, cost, and crime. If you want a quick kind of dummy's guide to the midterms, that's what it is for me. It's the poor candidates that my Republican friends like Brendan have chosen on their side that have made this more competitive than it should be. It's the issue of choice that have given Democrats the type of boost with enthusiasm that they would have needed in this type of cycle to push back on the winds of history. It's cost, which are really hurting Democrats all across the country, a difficult economy. And I think the fourth C is an emerging thing that's really concerning to a lot of Democrats that are paying attention right now, and it's crime. If Mandela Barnes loses in Wisconsin, it'll be because of crime. If John Fetterman loses in Pennsylvania, it'll be because of crime. Republicans have, decided to amp up the volume on that issue, particularly in the suburbs. And I think it's something Democrats really have to address. So there's a lot going on, but those are the things I'm looking at.
All right, Brendan, is that also what you're hearing and seeing in these debates, the ones that are actually happening between these candidates? Is it about candidate quality, choice from a reproductive justice perspective, cost as in our inflation, and crime as in our perception that in some cases reality that crime has increased?
Yeah, and I think each one of these debates is an opportunity for each party to pick which one of those they want the election to be about. As Joel rightly said, Republicans are increasingly hitting crime as a top issue. You know, we've talked for months and months and months about cost of living, and that is certainly going to be a top issue. But Republicans are banking on that and crime being what this election is about, and Democrats want this to be about abortion. And elections are typically only about one or two things, and it's a fight for what voters are actually going to cast their ballot on. I talked to somebody who was polling a lot of House races. And he found that the swing voters that are actually going to decide this election, they actually side with Democrats on abortion, and they think that the Dobbs decision was wrong and they're worried about it. But in their polling, they are seeing that by 2-1, those voters are prioritizing economic issues in their vote. They're casting their vote based on cost of living, even though they agree with Democrats on those issues. So that's the real contrast that exists. And these debates provide an opportunity for candidates to set the frame of the election.
I mean, do they though, Brendan? This is, I think, for me, really the thing I'm trying to get at. So I buy that it's about these issues, and I buy that it's very much about the capacity of a candidate and a campaign to make the campaign about the contest. But I guess for me, the real question is, are the debates where that's happening? Is it that people are tuning in, see, and particularly not just folks, right? Because we know that if you're kind of strongly partisan, you've already made the decision. It's just a question of if you're going to turn out to vote, right? But for the undecideds who are tuning in, are they like, you know, getting their popcorn, sitting down to their local public, you know, television station, watching it and saying, you know what? This debate is the thing that has moved me. Joel, do you have a sense? Is that framing happening in these contests between the candidates on stage?
So I think that this has really shifted kind of in what I would call the more recent political cycles. I don't know if I think debates are game changers. I think they're flashpoints, and I think that they're kind of a check engine light, a temperature reading, and they may reflect where a race is. But I don't know how many voters are tuning in and saying, you know, wow, Tim Ryan really outdueled J.D. Vance on that one point. So that has made my decision for me. I think it's a part of a narrative. It's a part of a collective storyline that campaigns hope to tell. What you hope for as a candidate is that you find a moment that you can really exploit. Someone gives a bad answer on an issue that you know is already on the minds of voters, and you can play that over and over and over again. But if you really look at it, that happens pretty rarely. I know in our minds, it can seem like it happens all the time, but it really doesn't. It's George Bush Sr. looking at his watch right on stage and looking inconsiderate on the economy. It's Donald Trump looming over Hillary Clinton on stage. It's someone giving a bad answer on crime, like Michael Dukakis, right? We glamorize those moments. Those are pretty rare. And those are increasingly rare, I think, in the last few years of the political cycle.
All right, Brendan, almost every example that Joel just gave us is from a presidential debate, not exclusively, but almost entirely. So I really am wondering, again, when we think about, for example, Vance and Ryan last night in Ohio, you know, going ahead and going toe to toe. And I got to say, it seemed less exciting than their Twitter battles.
Yeah, look, debates matter less than they ever have. And I don't think we can dispute that. You know, you can tell that by the fact that there are fewer debates than there used to be. And that's for a few reasons. One, I think you were getting at, we are much more tribal. People have already made up their mind. There are a lot fewer swing votes than there were to be decided at a debate. But secondly, campaigns don't need debates to reach people in the way that they used to. This used to be, like you said, a big moment where everybody sat down and said, okay, well, now I'm going to decide. But if you're a voter who has not made up their mind, the candidates, probably the campaigns at least, know that. And they know how to reach you. And they know how to reach you with messages that are going to persuade you to turn out. But most campaigns these days are much more built around motivation, getting voters to that they know are on their side to turn out, than they are about persuasion, convincing people that they should vote for them in the first place. So you show up because you sort of have to. There's an expectation. It's a bad look if you don't. But most campaigns are just glad to get through a debate, not have one of those moments that Joel is talking about, and move back on to the things that they want to focus on.
All right. So now you've laid out some more like hypotheses for me, right? So Joel, let's walk through these. So one is this hypothesis that, well, you kind of got to show up because if you don't, it's a bad look. I'm wondering if even that is still true. I mean, certainly what we've seen in this election cycle is a whole lot of candidates saying, you know what? Actually, I'm not coming.
Raphael Warnock has accepted 3 invitations to debate his opponent, Herschel Walker.
Yet Herschel Walker still refuses to agree to any debates.
Do you have an intention of dodging debates?
Oh, no, I don't dodge anything.
And I think Herschel Walker is kind of clearly at the top of that.
Yeah, we're in the post-shame era. and we're not just in politics, but in society, but definitely in politics. So, like, I don't think you can verbally bully somebody into a debate maybe the way you could 10, 15, 20 years ago. And when you do, even if they don't, like, I don't think J.D. Vance really, covered himself in glory in his recent debate. I don't get the sense that Herschel Walker is going to, you know, put on a tour de force in his debate coming up in Georgia when he and Senator Warnock talk soon. But I think that there's so much tribalism already baked in. Again, unless you say something that really, really goes against where they are. And even in those cases, I mean, look, Herschel Walker essentially is going against Republican orthodoxy in his personal behavior. And the voters there are telling you they don't care. And I think that that is a symptom of we're in this post-shame era. So I don't necessarily think so. I don't really think you can bully someone into a debate and then use that to really work against them. I think we're a little bit beyond that. And by the way, I don't know if that necessarily is a good thing for constituents or for voters when they're trying to make the best decision.
All right. So let's dig into exactly that space then. You know, as we are thinking about what's happening in Georgia, first, we've got Herschel Walker saying, you know, no, we're not going to debate. Then we are going to have a debate. And this idea of going against the personal sort of orthodoxy, right, or going against the Republican orthodoxy in personal behavior. Of course, you know, I might trace that back, right? But I'd be interested to see how you think about this, Brendan, right? There's a moment on the floor of the Republican National Convention in 2008 with Sarah Palin as the vice presidential nominee. Her teen daughter had been discovered to be pregnant and not yet married. And I can remember I was there and the sort of the hats that say, we love teen moms, right? In some ways consistent, right, with a Republican orthodoxy that is pro-life, right? But it also certainly went against sort of the narrative of family values that we'd heard prior. And then to the extent that maybe that had sloughed it off a bit, certainly by the time we get to 2016 and we're looking at sort of the actions, personal behaviors of the man who becomes president, right, Donald Trump. I'm wondering if even that notion within the Republican Party right now allows that Herschel Walker actually can't lose this debate, right? That as long as he shows up, he sort of has to win.
Well, he certainly lowered the expectations dramatically. And I think Herschel Walker is just a unique case where this is someone not just new to politics, but real questions about his capacity to handle issues, discuss basic matters that you will need to be able to discuss as a candidate. And he has said himself, trying to lower expectations, that he's not very smart and this is not going to go well for him. And so just showing up, I think, is probably, it's easy to say that that's enough, but I don't know that it is. And if he goes out on the stage and completely embarrasses himself, not understanding questions and saying bizarre things like he's been known to say on the campaign trail, that could hurt him, because this is a debate where I think people do want to actually see what this person actually is like. They've heard so much about him and his past. And at this point, Republicans are rallying around him because they have no real other choice. But while we're pretty tribal in Georgia in particular, we know that this is a state that is in transition. And there are a lot of voters who used to vote Republican who are now starting to vote Democratic. And he needs those people. And if he embarrasses himself on a debate stage, I think it actually could matter. So I think most debates probably don't change much, but this one actually has pretty high stakes for me.
All right, let's take a quick break with Joel and Brendan. We're going to be right back and talking more about debates and whether or not they matter in midterm 2022.
Hi, I'm Alexis Ohanian. You may know me as one of the co-founders of Reddit, but more recently, a large part of my identity is being a father to my wonderful daughters. In my podcast, Business Dad, I hope to open the conversation about working parents a bit. You'll get to hear from a wide range of business dads, from Rainn Wilson and Guy Raz to Todd Carmichael and Shane Battier, to find out how they balance being a dad with a successful career. Business Dad is available now, so be sure to listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You're back with The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and I'm still here with two fantastic guests. We've got Joel Payne from CBS News. He's a political contributor. And Brendan Buck, a former senior staffer with Representative Paul Ryan and John Boehner. And we've been talking about this question of debates and whether or not they'll make a difference in the 2022 midterms. All right, let's talk about the Arizona debate. This question of a debate that wasn't really supposed to be a debate, and then one of the candidates saying, nah, you're going to debate me. What in the world is going on in Arizona?
Well, Melissa, I guess what I would say about Arizona is this. Masters is the one that has the pressure on change the trajectory of the race. I don't believe that happened, right? I mean, look, there's going to be a lot of flashpoints that his campaign tries to point out, but I'll just tell you, if the key issues there are, do independents like Mark Kelly? I think they still like Mark Kelly after that debate. do voters on the Republican side think that Blake Masters is just weird? Has he diffused that issue? Not really. Also, is he out of step with the Arizona electorate on the issue of abortion? And I'd argue even kind of after that debate, Masters has said some comments about how he wanted to remove the standard on Griswold, on the Supreme Court case of Griswold, making contraception illegal. So I would say that, again, we talked about this before. These debates are really kind of flashpoints, and they are rare to change the trajectory. I don't think anything about the trajectory of that race changed with how Blake Masters performed and how Mark Kelly performed.
All right, I want to do one other Arizona race, and this is the race for governor. Katie Hobbs, the Democratic candidate for governor, who said she would not debate her opponent, Carrie Lake.
What I've been focused on is opportunities like this where they can see us back to back and hear directly from us about the issues that are important to Arizonans and how we would govern without a circus like she created during the GOP Republican primary. I have no desire to be a part of the spectacle that she's looking to create because that doesn't do any service to the voters of Arizona to hear from us where we stand on the issues and how we would govern.
So Hobbs and her opponent, Lake, did this town hall, right? They weren't supposed to appear together, but Lake actually sat on the front row when Hobbs took the stage. Lake was booed. She left the seat. Like, it got kind of wild. What was going on with that, Brendan?
Well, one of the tactics you often see is if you're the candidate who is leading a campaign, you have a lot less incentive to debate at all. And I think that's what you're seeing here is somebody who thinks that they can win without ever having to legitimize their campaign. Also, Carrie Lake has shown herself to be I don't want to use the word. She's quite eccentric as a candidate, says lots of bizarre things, conspiracy theories. And her Democratic opponent, I understand not want to be put in a position of having to respond to nonsense. And so I can understand why she wouldn't want to debate. But, you know, that's also, again, like you said, tough. Like if you're the one saying you don't want to debate, typically what you have is this sort of back and forth cat and mouse. Well, we'll debate this way. Well, I'll do it at this time. And usually they come to some type of accommodation. It's rare that they can't actually figure it out. So this is a situation where you've got one sort of kooky candidate and one candidate who is ahead in the races and doesn't feel like they need to give that person any platform to come back.
Is it possible to win a debate, or can you only lose one?
I think you can only lose one. You have much more to lose than you do to gain in a debate. And Joel talked about all the examples. It's rare to have somebody absolutely dominate someone so much that it changes the race for them. But it is much more common to have somebody fall on their face and disqualify themselves. You, like I said earlier, you really just want to get through one of these debates, survive, move on, maybe have a line that you can use on the debate stage or on the campaign trail. But after that, you want to forget about it.
Yeah, Melissa, there is just some rules to political gravity that apply here. And I want to go back to your kind of particular question about Lake and Hobbs. To answer your question you just asked, can you lose them or can you win them? Yeah, I think they're a lot easier to lose than they are to win. And I think that's right. I agree with Brendan's approach there. But I have these rules of political gravity. They're kind of like Joel's rules of politics, which may or may not be able to be used and replicated by others. Folks are welcome to, you know, test the patent on them. But one of them is, I think you have to be seen by the electorate and by constituents as wanting to win. And I think part of wanting to win is wanting to get into the fight. And I actually don't think it's a good look for Katie Hobbs to back off of that debate with Carrie Lake. Mm-hmm. Yes, Carrie Lake is kooky. Carrie Lake is also pretty charismatic, former TV host and somebody who I think it's interesting, as much as in that Senate race that I talked about earlier, Mark Kelly is kind of like the candidate that's controlling the tempo. I'd say that Carrie Lake is controlling the tempo in that governor's race. And I think if Katie Hobbs wants to beat her, she's got to take it. And I don't know if I would trust a poll that says that Katie Hobbs is ahead right now. And I think if you're Carrie Lake, you can easily kind of lean into Katie Hobbs for not being competitive and not wanting to go for it. So I just don't think that's a good look. And I don't think that's something that wears well with voters and with constituents. One other thing I would point out, too, is the strategic placement on the calendar of when these debates are happening. We talk about Election Day as this diffuse thing. It's going to be in November. It's in a couple of weeks. Election Day is starting like next week.
Right. People are voting right now.
Places. That's right. Yeah. And I think that that's an important thing to factor in as well. I think these debates are strategically placed on the calendar around early voting times and early registration periods. But I do think folks always have to remember that is like a debate might be happening 2 days before early voting starts in a county or mail-in voting opens up in a county. And I think that's an important thing to take into account as well.
All right. Thanks so much, guys. And I hope you'll come back and we'll sort of take a look at how all of these debates, so many coming up in the next couple of weeks, have or don't have an influence on this election cycle. Joel Payne, CBS News political contributor, and Brendan Buck, partner at 7 Letter. Thank you both for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Good to talk with you.